Our speaker tonight is Bruce Joel Rubin. As most of you know, Bruce is an Oscar-winning screenwriter and director with numerous hit movies to his credit. He's also, for his long decades of success in Hollywood, for every week, he's held meditation classes and talks in his home and continues to do so. He's very, very dedicated to the spiritual path, and we've had him talk here the last two retreats as well as this one. Last year when he spoke here, he introduced himself as the token unenlightened guy. This year he can't do that. Later that same weekend, as he listened to Paul Hederman talk, Bruce woke up. It's been a roller coaster year for Bruce, and I've been privileged to hear some about it, but I don't want to give too much away because it looks like we might hear something about it tonight. But regardless of what we hear from Bruce, it's going to be from the heart, one of the biggest hearts I've ever been privileged to know, my dear friend Bruce Rubin.
I didn't want to come here last year. I tried to get sick. I tried to find every excuse I possibly could not to show up, but I couldn't find anything. And I tried to say, what does it mean to come here to a group of enlightened people and to talk about what it means to not be enlightened? It felt like a sort of unnecessary trip. And I actually gave that talk for almost an hour, so clearly there was something to say about being unenlightened. And I had a wonderful time that weekend. It was really beautiful. It was a weekend like this, extraordinary people here. And after I gave the talk, two enlightened people came up to me and said, "You know, you're really enlightened, you just don't know it." And I said, "Well, what good is that?" It really had no benefit at all, and I found myself very disturbed by that. And I went, "Well, is that my phone? Wouldn't that be funny?" Sounds the same. So I just took it in stride, and the next morning, Sunday morning, which was a year ago in 1 week, the past week, I came here and sat in one of those sort of folding chairs in the back, very much prepared to just settle in and relax and just be here. And Paul Hederman, who I'd never heard of, was going to give a talk. And I had no idea what to expect. This man sat down, and I didn't understand a word he was saying. He was speaking with such velocity, with such intensity, with such lack of clarity from my perspective, that my mind could not process what he was saying, but I knew everything he was saying was true, profoundly true, but I couldn't get it. I just couldn't get it. I was trying as fast as I can to catch up to it, but I couldn't catch up, so I just stopped trying. When the talk was over, sitting back there, I sat there for a moment and I went, something's happened. Something happened. I couldn't explain it to myself, but I just knew something was different, really different. So I kind of got up and went over to Bart and I said, "You know, man, something happened." He said, "Great, man." And he gave me a hug, and I went to the bathroom right over there. And I'm standing in the bathroom peeing and saying to myself, "You can't just say thank you to a guy who just totally transformed your life." And I thought, "I got to come back." And so I came back in the room, and he's still standing there. I said, "No, Rand, really, something just happened." He said, "Great, man." And I thought, so I had to go over to Bart. And Bart was standing with Phil and a number of other people. And I said, "Bart, something happened." And Bart got all emotional, which made me all emotional. And then everybody around Bart got emotional. And I became, I guess, one of the first people to awaken during one of these sessions, which was both wonderful and problematic, because it now meant that if we had any more of these sessions and two or three people didn't wake up, it would be a failure. So you guys have got to work this through by tomorrow morning or tomorrow evening. You know, you got 24 hours to do this. But I honestly didn't know what to make of it. I had no idea. I can only tell you that the awakening was like nothing at all. I had expected, if one awakens, that it would be tumultuous on some level and transformative on another level. And what it was for me was like a shift like that. And all I knew, and the only way I could express it to myself, was that Bruce wasn't there anymore. That I was still there, whatever that means, but Bruce wasn't. And Paul kind of talks about it like there's a hand on your shoulder for 60 years, or in my case, 68 years, and then suddenly it's just not there. And all you're aware of is there's something different. Something is really different. And the idea that Bruce wasn't there was a very odd idea to me. I mean, I know we talked about it here, but the experience of Bruce not being there was very unusual. And so Bart and I went home that evening. I was lucky that he was gracious enough and has always been to let me stay in his home, which means we get to talk after for up to 2 to 3 hours. And we started talking, and I'm trying to understand, how can this happen in such a small, minute little way? You know, it's like blowing out a candle. And we kept talking, and I kept thinking it through, and I started tracing it back. And then I felt, and still do, that the awakening happened 40 years before. With my LSD trip, actually, which last year I talked about a great deal. So, you have a good LSD trip?
And I don't want to go through it again. I can only tell you, and maybe I'll tell you this much, it was a massive overdose of pure LSD liquid that was fresh from Sandoz Laboratory in Switzerland, and it was sitting in my refrigerator on Bank Street in New York, because the man who carried it from London to England, to America, was taking it up to Tim Leary at Millbrook. And it just happened to be in my refrigerator the night I was going to take my first LSD trip. And long story short, my friend had given me a big tablet of LSD to take, very big tablet, and it didn't work. So he said, well, we just happened to have a bottle of pure LSD in the refrigerator, I'll get you a little drop. So he goes and gets an eyedropper and fills it and goes to give me one drop, and he goes, whoops. And the entire eyedropper, literally thousands and thousands of micrograms, went down my throat. And what happened that night, which I talked about extensively last time, but in the short-term experience, well, let me put it this way. In my short explanation of it, I died. Bruce died, death occurred, the universe died with me, everything that was, could be, would ever be, completely imploded. It took a very long time, I expressed last year, somewhere between 2 and 3 billion years, but it was really, really intense, terrifying. I had no idea that my entire psyche would be dismantled before my eyes, and I would watch every memory of every cell in my body give itself over to something I could not comprehend, and I just watched death happen, and I was horrified. I was horrified in ways that are hard to explain, but it truly, truly took everything. And then, after this long period, there was nothing there, just this. And into that, something went, and I kind of heard it, or felt it. And then whoever I was, or wherever I was, went and broke into 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, on and on and on. And my body, the room I had been in, New York City, New York State, the planet Earth, and the solar system, and the whole universe recreated itself. And I was back. And I said, why? Why am I back? And no answer was given. But something in me knew it was to tell people about it. This was something that happens, and I didn't get it. And I spent the rest of my life up until this microsecond figuring it out, trying to figure it out. And of course, one of the things it led me to was Bart. And this journey to Bart and this journey to Paul sitting here was aggressive. I did not go gentle into this new journey. I was working at NBC News as a film editor. I quit my job. I hitchhiked to India. I went to Tibet. Not Tibet, but to Nepal. I lived with Tibetans. I visited every human being in the world who could teach me about this that I knew about at the time. I spent time with the Dalai Lama. I spent time with the Maharishi. I mean, I went to so many people trying to get it. And nobody was right. Nobody was able to teach me what I was looking for. And His Holiness was actually very kind. He said, I'm happy to be your teacher. And we were having a private audience in Dharamsala. And I said, I don't think you're my teacher. Is a meditation. It's called Kundalini Yoga, but it's really beyond that. It's an energetic work. It's a work of transmission between teacher and student, eyes open, sharing, accountable energy exchange between people. And it's very powerful. I've been doing it for a long time, and I love the practice. I find it very, very compelling. I actually met the Dalai Lama again at a party. Richard Gere was having a party. And Richard reintroduced me to him and said that I had met him all those years ago. He said, oh, you must have had more hair. So he still luckily remembered, yes. I think he did not remember. But the journey was long and constant. And I began to teach. And I have had a lot of students. And mostly what I taught them was what I learned from my teacher, which was, this is work. It's work to grow. It's work to be a happy human being. It's work in this world to transform yourself into something real and productive, that your life, your day-to-day life, is your spiritual life, that it's not about going into a cave, it's not about disappearing somewhere, it's about this here, and make it work. So what it really involved, I discovered in the last year or two, was that it was a work that said, my life as it isn't right. Something is wrong, change it. Make it better. There's work to be done. And what started to come to me through the beginning of Introduction to Advaita and to Nisargadatta and Eckhart Tolle and all of Adyashanti, all these people, what came to me was the need to make it other robs you of the opportunity to know what is and to live what is. And living what is not necessarily easy. It's actually a kind of very heroic act. To live what you find in any given moment has the potential to bring you into what I call a portal. And trust me, I don't know what I'm talking about. So this is my idea of what it is. I may be wrong, but the experience is there is a kind of portal and it suddenly goes, there you are. And I can't tell you where you are, but you're there. And it has to do with not fighting where you are. Just being. And that was very important information for me. After I met Paul, and I was sitting with Bart, and I sort of began to think that it took me 40 years to arrive at awakening, I then said what I think Deborah said, now what? Now what? And, you know, Bart can't in one night tell me now what, really. Just enjoy, basically, go forward. And so I got on the airplane to go back to New York, and I said to myself, who am I? If I'm not Bruce, who am I? And the answer that came was, I am that. And the minute the answer of I am that came, I started crying. And I just kept crying. And I thought, I'm just like Mark, because he had the exact same experience on an airplane. So now everyone who wants to get enlightened has to take an airplane trip right after their awakening so they can go through this experience. But it was really, it was very powerful. The whole airplane trip was powerful. And then, of course, everything that came following that was very powerful. I arrived back in Los Angeles, and I said, oh my God, how do I deal with my life? It's not even my life. There's no Bruce here. What do I do with this life? And I was afraid to see my wife. I was afraid to see my kids. I was afraid to see my brother and sister-in-law who were going to come over probably for dinner. I didn't know how to handle the world. And I got home, and nobody was there, luckily, and I immediately went into my office and locked the door and sat there. I think Bart had a similar experience, but he stayed in the closet longer, or in the office longer than I did. I finally said, well, you can't do this. You got to come out, and you got to deal with life, whatever it is, with whoever you are. And I just took the step to come out of that office, and my wife Blanche was there, and I said, something has happened. And I tried to explain it, of course. I mean, she's been doing spiritual work with me all of this time, so she was not unprepared for something to happen, which is a great blessing if you have a partner who knows what you're talking about. But she was threatened. He said, what does this mean for us? How is this going to work now that you're not Bruce? And the answer that came to that question, which was very powerful, was, I love you more than Bruce ever did. And it worked. But it was true. It was true. The love that was pouring out of me was enormous. It was so enormous I couldn't sleep at night. I would get in bed, I would lie down, and my heart chakra, and I work a lot on the chakras, so I'm aware of them as energy centers, and my heart chakra was just all night, and it was loving the universe. It was loving everything. It was just pouring forth in every possible way. And I didn't care if I slept or not because I was so happy. And I just lie there and just love. And I felt, well, that's maybe what I am now. I'm just a lover of the universe. And I'll just love whatever I can. And it was an extraordinary experience because I started loving everybody in ways. I mean, I do love. I mean, I generally have a big heart. And I love a lot of people. But this was just indiscriminate. It just loved. It just kept loving. And I said, fine. I will be that. But then I tried to explain to people what had happened to me, and that doesn't play well. Most people don't have a clue to what you're talking about. And if you have smart, intelligent friends who are Buddhists or otherwise inclined, they go, no, you know, it doesn't work like that. You can't be enlightened like that. Enlightenment is sitting under the bow tree for your whole life and fasting and, you know, and fighting off the demons and doing all of this stuff. And so whatever you have is good, it's nice, but it's not enlightenment. I go, well, maybe not. Maybe it's not enlightenment. Maybe it's something else. But I don't know. It felt like awakening on some level. Certainly everything we had talked about as awakening, which meant the loss of certainly the ego sense, it was gone for a bit. And then something started to happen, which luckily Paul Hederman had addressed, and he called it selfing. Selfing is when remnants of the old self, which I personally call Brucing, start to arise, and they start to come up and express themselves. And you can see it very clearly. Oh, that's Bruce. And there's this thing that's seeing it and actually has some control over it. So at first I got scared of it, and then I remember, because I didn't want to lose myself back to Bruce. I'll tell you, I didn't want to be Bruce again. I mean, one of the greatest things of losing yourself is it's such a relief. You know, all of the stuff about you that you don't like disappears, and what remains is the stuff that was always wonderful, the real stuff. The stuff you love stays. the stuff you hated, gone. Except there I was, it was coming back. And it was coming back here, right here, heart chakra area, it was vibrating. And I got really disturbed by it, and then I just went, get out, like that. And it left, gone. And I said, wow, I don't have to be Bruce. And if Bruce tries to come in, I have control. And I will get that out of me. And that's what I did. And I would do that until it didn't kind of reappear very often. And if it did, it did. And I tried to understand, what is this, Bruce and non-Bruce? Because I'm still here. I am still here. But Bruce is not here, except occasionally. And so I started to philosophize, and in some ways using scientific principles of the understanding of light. Light is, we are told, a wave and a particle at the same time, which means nothing to most people. I mean, what? You know, you can't figure that out. How can it be a wave and a particle at the same time? And they say it all depends on how you observe it. If you observe it one way, it's a wave. If you observe it another way, it's a particle. And I began to think Bruce is a particle, non-Bruce is a wave. And we're the same thing. There's this little particle and there's this vast wave of being. And that they somehow operate as a whole. And Bruce didn't have to, how can I say, completely die or disappear, because they haven't. I mean, he was still making himself known. So there was just this vastness and this tiny little thing all working in tandem as a whole. And whether this dovetails with any kind of other people's awakening or enlightenment, I have no idea. This is my story. So there I was with moments of Bruce and mostly this largeness, this incredible largeness, and the sense of walking around as a kind of blessing to people. And I don't mean that I'm owning that as Bruce being a blessing to people. It just simply felt like anyone who was in front of me, who appeared in front of me, was in touch with himself, with the self. That's what it felt like. They're in touch with the self. And really their self. And that self was loving them, just loving them, exactly as they were. And it felt like an extraordinary privilege to be that, to just be a source of love for others. Every so often I could feel the ego going, hey, I'm a source of love for others. And I would just say, like that. But it did get confusing at times. And I really was trying to incorporate this new sense of self into what was still a very much a daily life. I still had a life of career. You know, a lot of people have talked about that here. What do you do when you awaken and you still have to go to a job and you have a family and you have money to make and all these other issues? You can't just walk away. Although maybe you can, but I couldn't. I was in the middle of writing a screenplay, and I was about to do a musical, a Broadway-style musical in England. And these were very pressing, and they needed me to function. And writing is something I can function with, because when Deb was talking today, you know, when I write, I pretty much disappear into the writing. I really do. The writing flows, and if it doesn't flow, you can tell. It looks horrible. But when you disappear into the writing, it just comes out, and it really, you're not there. It's not you doing it. And the best stuff work I've ever done, I had nothing to do with, basically, or Bruce had nothing to do with. And Bruce always acknowledged that. Bruce never took ownership of anything that was written, ever. So the writing was not terribly problematic. What was problematic was the musical. And I was we were about to change some songs, and I had to go meet with the composers. And I had written some of the lyrics, and they had written some of the lyrics. I may have told you this story last year, I don't know. The director of the musical, who's a very prominent director, he came to me during some of the workshops, and he said, Bruce, you know, your songs, your lyrics are good, but we have two of the best songwriters in the world working on the show. Why do we need you? And that was unbelievably humbling. And actually, it was more like wanting to commit Harry Carey. He just said, let's let these guys have a hand at writing some of these songs. So I said, okay. And they started writing more and more and more of the songs, with my blessing, quite honestly, because they are. One guy's name is Dave Stewart, who's part of a group called The Eurythmics with Danny Lennox, and you may know him. The other is Glenn Ballard, who produced Jagged Little Pill with Alanis Morissette and Michael Jackson's Bad Album. So they're very talented people. And so I had a meeting with at their house to write a new song, and I showed up there, and there was no Bruce. And Bruce was necessary, because Bruce was the one they relate to, and Bruce was the one who had to work on this on these songs. And I was like a fish out of water. I was so unable to work, to do this. I didn't know how to participate. I felt really uncomfortable. I mean, I didn't feel, I felt, you know, loving. You know, I was... but I couldn't figure out how to quite do the work. So what happened, basically, was they started to do the work, and in truth, the song we were working on at that moment, we're still working on it, and that's a long story. We're still working on that song. This is years later and the show's playing. I found it very hard to figure out how to be a participant in something which I'd been working on for 4 years up to that point. It's a musical, by the way, of a movie I wrote called Ghost. So this is what we're doing. We're turning it into a big Broadway-style musical. And I wanted... maybe it was Bruce, but truly there's an I wanted to be part of this unbelievably thrilling experience, and it truly proposed itself as something remarkable. And the director said to me again, I don't really need you here in London for the early part of the show. He said, you can come later. I said, no, I want to be there. I really want to be part of this. I don't want to be absent from it. And I think it's important to the show that I show up, that I be there. And I didn't mean that, again, as Bruce, I meant it as I. That somehow there was a protective force emanating that really needed to be part of this show. So I worked out something with him, which was that I would come to London, I would not say a word. I would sit quietly, actually on the very end of the last table after the prop people, down there, and just be. I would not do, I would be. I didn't even know what that meant, but I knew that it was important. And I told all the actors, I said, I know you are all going to have questions for me about motivation, why I wrote it this way, and what does that line mean, and how can we do it? I said, do not ask me. Ask the director, that's his job. I have no job here, I'm just here. And so there I sat. And I have to say, for the 2 months that we spent developing the show, people looked at me like, who's he? You know, what's he doing here? And then they would hear I was the writer, and they knew that I was the writer, but they didn't know what to do with me because I was totally silent. And I just sat, and I did this. I mean, not with my legs crossed. That's all I did. And the next thing I knew, people were coming up and hugging and kissing me. I wasn't saying, they just would come up and say, can I give you a kiss? Can I give you a hug? And they were all beautiful. And I turned and said, sure. And I hugged them back. And then more and more, the director would say, you know, why don't you help me with, let's fix this thing. Do you have any ideas for this, for that? And I just, whenever I was asked, I would contribute to this process. And there was an aura of love and well-being and joy that started to filter into this rehearsal process that went into every actor and dancer and singer in the room. And it started to infuse the show. And the show went from London, we went up to Manchester to put it on for the first time, kind of the out-of-town tryout. And something remarkable happened. First of all, the opening night, The director got on the stage before the show. I had no idea he would do that. And he explained to the audience that this was a preview show. Things could go wrong. He apologized if they did. And then he said, and I want to tell everybody that the writer of the show is in the auditorium, and everybody applauded, which is a very bruising kind of moment. and then he said, and Bruce, this is for you. Mm. And I got all teary-eyed. But I got teary-eyed partly because he had addressed it to this being on some level, but because he was able to say that. You have to know this guy. He doesn't normally say, this is for you. It's usually, this is for me. But he truly gave it away. And he gave it away because I wasn't there. I was simply present. The power of presence is so remarkable, so exciting to live with, that when it occurs, you can actually feel a kind of addiction to it. Now, I'm talking, when I say you, I don't mean me, because I think those of you who have awakened here may describe it very differently and be completely right in your own terms. So I'm not trying to speak for the truth, I'm talking about my own truth. But what happened that night was unforgettable for us. The show went on. The show is really wonderful. I'm going to show you a little bit of it in a second. The show went on, and the show is so full of love, so full of energy, of what I would even call Shaktipat. You know that name? It's what happens when you transmit energy to people. Shaktipat goes into the system, it goes into the chakras, and opens channels inside people. This show became a conveyor of Shaktipat. So people who see it without understanding how and why are energized in some profound way. They are so moved. People told me the other night they just went to see the show in London. They were sitting, they had no seats left, so they were sitting in a box that we don't usually sell tickets to because you can't see all the effects and illusions. But they were sitting up there and they said at the end of the show, one of them hit the other like this and looked down. The entire auditorium had turned into a sea of white with people's tissues coming up to their eyes, and up in the balcony, the same thing. It both brings you to wonderful laughter and deep, deep tears, and it really opens you. And the very end of the show involves illusions that are like the most remarkable thing you've ever seen on stage, literally the most remarkable things. The final moment, one of the final moments, is our main guy, Sam, saying goodbye to Molly. He walks away, and he stands in the middle of the stage, and he just waves goodbye, and she waves goodbye, and in front of your eyes, it disappears. Gone. It's so remarkable. It's like, you do it in a movie, and people go, eh. You do it on stage, and you're actually looking at, you know, if it was as if Luke right now just disappeared. That's what it would be like. Each of you would go, and that's what the entire audience does. And that leads us to the very last moment of the show, at which point, as the curtain started coming down, the entire audience started screaming, yelling, jumping to their feet, stomping their feet on the ground, applauding, whistling, everything, and it was scary. And it was so intense, the feedback, what they had been given, they wanted in a way to give back. I mean, in a way it's too bad because they should have held on to it. But they don't know to do that, and they just sent it back to the actors and to the stage. And it was truly, truly beautiful. And the director turned to me and said, I've been in theater for 30 years, I've never seen this. And we all had this just amazing experience with it. And for me, it was a blessing and a curse. The blessing was that we had created something truly beautiful and I had been totally out of the way. The curse was, now I care about the show. Now Bruce cared about the show. And I didn't really know that yet. I was pretty good during the whole Manchester run. But then when we went to London, I got working. I started thinking, I now have something to lose. I really want this to be. I really want the audience to love it there as much as they did in Manchester. This rooting interest thing started to happen. So let me talk quickly about rooting interest. At the same time all this is happening, just before I actually went to London, my oldest son Josh and his wife Evan gave birth to my first granddaughter. He's cutest, sweetest. This is 9 months old. This is presence. If you want to know what presence looks like in a human being, this is total presence. There is no obstruction. There is no filter. She is just there. And I sit with her, and I feed on that presence, and I try to bring her the same presence. And the two of us have arrived at a relationship, which is one of the best relationships in my life. And I finally understood, I finally met someone who's on my level. But her birth became a very important part of all of this. And so I have now given birth to a play and to a granddaughter. But during her actual birth, physically, we were told that her mother had gone she was in labor, she was not pushing. And then we didn't hear anything for 5 hours. And the worry that started to happen at that moment was enormous. And all I could think of, well, who's worried? Who's worried? Who is concerned? But I couldn't find the roots exactly, and I would probably be better with it. I came up with another theory. Again, forgive me those of you who were farther along the path than I. But my theory was that the universe is worried. Not worried, rooting. Rooting for the success of this birth. Rooting not just for the birth of my granddaughter, but rooting for every one of us. That there is a rooting factor in the universe that wants the best for every one of us, and it cares about us profoundly. Now, if I'm wrong, forgive me, but it sure felt right. And this love of us is more than any of us understands or can probably bear, but it is real. I mean, it felt real to me. It wants our well-being, both, I suppose, as ego entities, because it created us as ego entities, and as awakened entities. It's just, we are in a loving universe. That's what I understood, that love is the core of it all, just the core. And everything that's not in that loving space is ignorance in us. So now I was rooting for the musical only. And Bruce was for the musical. Bruce really snuck back into the picture in a very big way. And I forgive myself if that's the case, and if this is Bruce speaking, I don't think it is. But I forgive this because it's hard to do a musical without it. It's such a big event. It feels like such a big event. And I would have been better off if I could have said, I'm free of this, but I did not pull that off. So I want to continue talking about the show a little bit, and I thought I would show you a little bit of it so you know what I'm talking about rather than have it be some abstraction. So we're going to take 2.5 minutes to show you a trailer that's on YouTube. And you can watch it, maybe just try the lights for a minute. And this is a very glitzy trailer. So trust me, it's not the perfect sense of the show, but it's a good sense.
Reawaken, won't give up, won't end.
that really barely gives you a sense of it, but it really, I just wanted you to understand that it's a lot of work putting on a musical. You know, building sets, teaching dancers, lights, everything else. It just was an enormous amount of work. And so as we moved toward London, this thing started to happen. And the thing that started to happen was anxiety. And I started to feel, this might not work here. It's a sophisticated audience. It may not play. And I could feel this old pattern. And rather than getting rid of it, it just started to assert itself. Excuse me. And I was embarrassed by it. I was truly embarrassed by it. I had been giving talks for my class from Manchester the whole time I was there, and it was really, they were wonderful and enthusiastic, and you can hear them online if they mean anything to you. And they were very much about presence and oneness. But I, when I got to London, I couldn't do the talks. I just stopped for the whole time I was in London. And I didn't know what to say, because I didn't know what was happening. And then all of a sudden, my brother-in-law and sister arrived, and it's really interesting. Three people, I guess maybe they're all my students, all awakened. And my brother-in-law was one of them. And they came to visit in London, and the minute they knocked on the door, their arrival reawakened this entire sense of presence, if you will. And I understood the gift of what I call Sangha, of people coming together in the name of this, and what we all get here every time you come here, the gift of Sangha, of being together with people. It's based on the idea that Christ said that when two people gather in my name, I am there. In the Buddhist sense, Sangha, two people, 400 gather, it comes, it returns, it's there. And I was so benefited by their arrival, so joyous that they were able to revive this in me, and then I reflected it in them, and it became wonderful. And the next thing I knew, my granddaughter came, so it just kept happening, and I was back into presence, and it was really terrific. I'm going to give you the whole story, so forgive me. I don't know how this plays out here for you. It's a kind of a two-act story without a completion, but. But the show opened in London to mostly good reviews. We'll call them mixed reviews. But I had decided not to read the reviews because I was told there's no benefit in reading the reviews, and I didn't. I didn't read them at all, and people just showed me told me about there were good ones and 4 stars and all that, and we can fill a whole 2 pages of a newspaper with the good reviews, which we have done and will do in New York. But what happened was my son said to me, that my younger son, and my wife and I should just take a trip somewhere after the show opened, and he suggested the Isle of Man. Nothing personal about the Isle of Man, but it is like the Twilight Zone. It is like going to a place where no one lives. And so you are the only people there, and they just kind of show a few people around occasionally to make you think it's populated. And I hated the Isle of Man. And I wanted to go home, but you don't just go home from the Isle of Man. It's a... So we were in this very strange Twilight Zone hotel and having a very weird time. And I'm opening the computer one morning, and I'm looking at the New York Times, and I see something about haunted something, and I don't know what that is. And I go to see it. Haunted clearly affected me. And I open it up, and it's a review of Ghost by the New York Times. But they, you know, they're the New York Times in New York. They're not in London. The critic for the New York Times was in London. He saw the show and hated it. And I went, how can you have audiences jumping to their feet? And they did in London, just like in Manchester, the exact same thing. To this day, they do it. And this guy hated the show. Well, the only possible way I could deal with that was remembering that the movie, when it opened, was hated by most of the critics. Most of the critics just said, dismissed it as a nothing film. And I remember being really hurt by that, but of course it went on to be nominated for an Oscar, and you know, and made a lot of money. And so I was kind of blindsided by that, and also I was blindsided by the fact that it was in the New York paper, and I have many friends in New York City. And then I went on Variety. I went to look at Variety, which is the trade paper for the movie business, because a friend of mine's movie had opened, and I wanted to see the review for his movie. And there was a review of Ghost. I had no idea, and they hated it worse than the New York Times. So everywhere I knew people who would have an opinion about me would all now think, poor Bruce, his show's a failure. And I got really, really thrown by it. And then I went out to dinner with my wife and my son. At the Isle of Man, the only two restaurants open on the entire Isle of Man on a Sunday night were Kentucky Fried Chicken and a Mexican restaurant. And you don't want Mexican food on the Isle of Man. Trust me. But we sat down and I guess I wasn't very happy. And my son said, "Why are you so negative? Why are you always so negative?" And my wife said, "Yeah, why are you so negative?" Well, I will be honest with you, I don't know what happened at that moment, but I got shoved into the deepest, darkest hole I have ever been in my life. It was, I think, New York Times, Variety, my son Ari and my wife Blanche, pow, pushed me down into this hole, and I could not speak for 2 days. Literally could not speak. So here I am, an awakened soul in an abyss of darkness. And so not only am I upset that I am so thrown by this experience, but I have lost presence. I truly lost it. And so it was like a double whammy. And I was ashamed by it, just deeply ashamed. And I didn't know what to do. And I couldn't talk. I literally couldn't talk. I couldn't talk to my wife. I couldn't talk to my son. My poor son was feeling terribly guilty. He didn't know what he had done or how this had worked. But it really impacted us. As a whole family, it impacted us. And I spent the next 2 months trying to crawl out of this hole that I had fallen into. And the hardest thing for me was coming back to the States and teaching, because I had to walk into my class and say something. And I just felt, as I said, shame. So I found the only thing I could do was be honest. And in the end, it's the only thing any of us can do. And I gave a talk, which was deeply disturbing. The most disturbing part of it was that when I talk, usually in my classes, and I've been doing this for a long time, 30 years, a teacher shows up, a voice shows up. It's happening now. There's somebody speaking to you right now. And it's giving what it's supposed to give. It did not show up in this talk at all. There was just this purely pathetic little kid sitting there trying to explain itself away. And it was just humiliating and difficult. And the worst thing was everyone came up to me afterwards and said, "I have an acupuncturist, you can see. You know, if you try these herbs, you know, everybody has, everyone, when you get sick in this community, everyone has an approach to what will help you. And when you look like you're getting mentally ill, they're even more active." So I was suffering. I was really suffering. And I will tell you, I would come downstairs in our house in upstate New York, and I would stand there. And I should also tell you, in the middle of all of this, when this all first happened, I decided I no longer wanted to be part of the movie business, which I had been in for 25 years. And I called my agent and said, "I'm done. I'm retired." I said, "Do not look for work for me." I just didn't want to make movies anymore. Part of that fell away. I mean, it was a really identifying element of my personality, of Bruce, gone. So I got up in the daytime, in the morning in New York. I had nothing to do. My wife said, "Why don't you have projects?" I don't know why I don't have projects. I've never had a project in my whole life other than writing, you know, keeping the work going. So I had nothing to do. And I would walk down into the library and I would stand there. I don't know if I should make a left turn, a right turn, go into the sitting room or the library or the sunroom. I didn't know where to go. So I just stood there. 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Then I had to go to the bathroom, thank God, and I got out of there. But I said, "This is terrible. Now what? I have nothing to do. And then it hit me that presence had become absence. Or more importantly, I was starting to face for the first time nothingness. That there was nothing there. There was nothing that I had to fill the space. And I had no idea what to do to fill that space. I had no idea. And so I was inert. And things started to happen, and I would work, and I would read the newspaper, and I did a lot of walks with the dogs. That's what I did a lot of that. And then we had a flood. The Hurricane Irene came to us and washed out our driveway and washed out our ponds and washed out our bridges and everything gone. So I had a lot of work to do as a result. And I will tell you a secret. This is an old secret from back in the 60s, when I once had a very bad depression when I came back from India. It was not dissimilar. I came back from India and I sat on a friend's couch or bed, actually, and didn't move for 4 days. I was catatonic. I don't know why. I don't know what happened. I didn't know how to face the world. I had no idea. And he got a delivery of about a ton of wood that had to be taken up 3 flights of stairs to rebuild their apartment. And he needed help. And he was so nervous about me sitting in his bedroom anyway, just like that. So he said, "Could you please help me?" And I said, "Yes." And I discovered that with every board I lifted up 3 flights of stairs, the depression fell away and fell away and fell away until by the end of this, I was a different person. The flood had some of that same effect. It brought me back into functioning in the world. And I started giving talks to my class about nothingness. And then in the middle of all of that, I started to have flashbacks to my LSD trip. And the flashback was, I was facing death again. But it wasn't Bruce really facing death. Maybe it was, but it felt like what I call this elemental entity facing death. It was pure existential terror. Absolute, beyond mentioning, something was going to cease to be. I think for the truly awakened and enlightened, they've already been past this. That's my guess. But for somebody like wherever I was at or where I am at, that force arose. And it is the worst and ugliest force there is. And I talk about it because I mentioned it in class and because, I will tell you in a moment, I'm not the only person experiencing this at this moment in time. I will tell you what it feels like. 2 things. I describe it this way. It feels like you are on the 102nd floor of the World Trade Center, and there's a fire a foot away from you behind you, and there is a 102-story drop. And you have 2 seconds to choose. And you are frozen in that. You become frozen in that. I mean, death at that point, it's not like, do I have time to call my wife? Or what about the person I didn't tell I love them? It's over. And it is dark and difficult. At the same time that that's happening, there is a kind of internalized voice, and this may just be personal and madness, except I'm hearing it from other people. And that voice tells you, nothing is real. Your whole life is a sham. Everything you loved isn't real. Love is a torment. Hope is a worse torment. That everything that you believed in isn't true. And we're taking it all away, and we are leaving you in a state of absolute and total darkness and madness. And that's what you get. You're done. That's what it feels like. That's what they tell you. And I will tell you, you cannot argue this away. It is so intelligent, it is so smart, that you cannot say anything to it that will allow you to win. And you all know here, the title of my last talk was Death Wins. I probably lost half my students. But it is a fact that death wins on a certain level. This darkness, which is darker than any dark night of the soul that I had ever gone through before. And I've had a number of those, and which I think is a little bit more like Luke's night terrors, and maybe of the same ilk and maybe other. But whatever it is, it's real. And I don't know why I need to tell you that it's real, but I think it's important. And I had a number of experiences. One of them is the night this happened, I taught class 2 days later. One of my students arrives at my house, who I haven't seen in a long time. And he said, I came to your class because I had this horrific experience the other night. And he describes to me my experience. He had it the same night I had it. I went to see Paul Hederman last week. Could have been this week, recently. And had dinner with a woman who was sponsoring this event who had come back from an Adi Ashanti weekend. The same night, she had the same experience. And she almost had to go to the hospital because she was so traumatized by the loss of this, of herself, of loss of what, of death. The absolute biological fear of death, and the unwinnable situation that one finds oneself in. So when I started talking to Andrew, he started telling me, and I'm not allowed to quote this supposedly, but of another very great and important teacher that we all know about, has had the same experience, the exact same experience that I'm describing, hiding under the covers, shaking, just before this person's enlightenment. I was promised that I wouldn't say who it was, but a major, major player. And I started to say, huh, why is this all converging? And then I started getting letters from people who were listening to my talk saying, this is what I had to hear. I'm having the same experience. So I'm looking at this convergence, which is very new to me. I have no idea what this is about other than the fact that this is all one thing, and why shouldn't it all be reflecting itself? But the incredible thing is we're talking about it and sharing it. And I have to say, talking about it diffuses it. And one of the way people have gotten through it, this very famous person, the way they got through it was they heard a voice way in the distance, like a million miles away, and it said, it's not real. It's not real. But I'm telling you, nothing in you would believe that when you, because it's as real as it gets. But it's a very important voice. In my earlier episodes with this thing, I've awakened in terror, and it really has impacted me badly. This time, what I did, which was really helpful, I just stared at it. I just kept staring at it. I acknowledged that it was real. I kind of offered it some kind of respect because it seemed to want that. And then I started to sing, "Hello, darkness, my old friend. I'm here to talk to you again." And that just lifted me out of it. I sang to it rather than hated it or feared it. I just acknowledged, respected, and sang to this dark force. But when morning came, it was still there. It's still there now. And I tell you this because I don't know what to make of it. And I think most truly awakened, enlightened people would say either this is the beginning of a final phase, or you're mentally deranged, you know, or this is just something you don't want to talk to people about. And the only reason I'm talking to you about it is because I think it's important to share it. And also to let you know this, my awakening did not abide in the traditional sense. It has come and gone and now found some other expression. And that expression is what is. And that what is really, really intense. Because what is now incorporating an enormous darkness, which is no longer a illusion to me or a fantasy. It's the exact thing that causes people to kill themselves, to start wars, to create holocausts. It is a real thing for me. And the other people that I was speaking to who were moment to moment, line by line, on the same page with me. So it's there, and here I am, and I am walking through my day knowing that this, whatever you might call it, the Damocles sword over my head, or Yamataka. Someone said to me, give it the name Yamataka, which is the Tibetan god of death. And it's certainly a wrathful deity. And we all know from Tibetan studies that wrathful deities really are not wrathful in the end. They really are peaceful. Or Shiva really is the god of destruction. But what does Shiva destroy but ignorance and darkness? Whatever it is, it is. And I tell you this from my own perspective because I don't know what else to talk about. I can't give you a pretty picture. And I would love to give you a pretty picture from my perspective. And I think it ultimately is, I won't call it pretty, I'm gonna call it something else. I think it's beautiful. I think it's entirely beautiful. I don't get it, I can't explain it. I don't know why it is what it appears to be, but I am grateful to be living aware and awake to these forces of both love, joy, my granddaughter, pinpricks of starlight in a very dark sky, and this enormous weighty darkness. All alive, all present, all very real. And what I find is that as I accept them, I'm no longer accepting, you know, the fact that my mail didn't arrive today and, you know, and that, you know, the car got scratched. I'm dealing with the Lord of Darkness itself and my granddaughter. And I'm discovering that love, friendship, compassion are unbelievably precious. Unbelievably precious and strong enough to balance the darkness. But you need them. You need them. Without love, without compassion, without friendship, connection, you can't balance the darkness. It wins. But when you have those forces working in a perfect yin-yang harmony, something happens. Now, I don't know what happens because I'm still kind of waiting, but it allows me to come here and share this with you. I have to say, at one point, Glenn, wherever you are sitting, said to me, are you okay? Are you sure you're okay? And I went, oh my God, what's wrong? He can tell. He can tell that I'm not okay. And I got so upset, I walked over to the lake and I sat there and said, I can't give this talk tonight. How can I say any of this? I don't know what to say. I was totally like this, you know, and feeling really, really unhappy and unwilling to do this. And then something else said, true courage in life is to walk into the darkness, to walk into the unknown, to do the uncomfortable, to hold yourself against all those forces or in league with all of them, to open up, to make yourself present and be real with what is. Be real. So I'm being as real with you as I can. I'm being as honest with you as I can. It's not as pretty a picture as some can paint, and probably because I'm not at the total pretty place, but as I said before a minute ago and will say again, it is beautiful. It is beautiful. What is beautiful is this. And I've learned this a long time ago. I've had wonderful spiritual experiences, the LSD experiences, the spiritual experiences. I mean, really, stuff you can write books about. I'll tell you, as far out as I've gone into the universe, as the journeys I've made into so many different dimensions, and really, I mean, astounding stuff, where do I always end up? Right here. I always end up here. No matter where I go, no matter what happens, no matter how grand it gets or chaotic or fantastic, whatever, I always come back to this. So, here we are. This is it. This is all there is. There's nothing else but this, and this is it. Accept it. And if you accept it, the portal opens up and here you are. And you're here and you're not here. Or you are really here. Really here, because this is, and as much as we are ultimately in an illusory state, as much as the fact that it starts with nothing and ends with nothing, and this must therefore be nothing in between, we're here. We're here. So this is the Bruce Rubin story. It's the Bruce Rubin, or whatever you want to call it, this self's truth. And I am in no way painting a picture of this as being real or more than my story. So if it resonates with you and talks to you and helps you on your journey, that's wonderful. If it makes you feel like this isn't the journey you want to be on, trust me, there are a lot of other people to talk to who paint a different picture, and I think valid picture. And I would say seek everybody out. Seek out the ones who speak to you. And I'm only giving you a kind of truth, but I don't know what else to do, and that's why I showed up here tonight. So thank you for having me. I assume I can take some questions if people want to ask questions.
So, I mean, you're Bruce. Your heart is so huge. And I've seen you for the last two retreats. You're sitting there, and you know, you're warming up to what you just talked about with darkness. But before that, I'm wondering, why am I... That's what I was feeling. The whole time.
The whole time.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That
the whole time I'm talking?
Right, the whole time I'm talking. Yeah. And so, it was very kind of something up with me. What's, maybe I'm not feeling from my heart chakra in the way that I should be or something, but.
Should I apologize?
No, absolutely not. And actually, I really appreciate you giving so much voice to that. And even when you said that it seems to be happening, you know, I alluded to earlier when I was sharing that in the last month and a half, what you're describing is really feels so similar. And
I'm hearing it from a fair number of places right now.
Yeah.
And it seems to me to be almost sociological, cultural, like something is going on. I mean, it kind of makes sense. But I figured if I just was honest about it, it would help other people be real with it themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that's more without even saying it. You know, mm-hmm. I think it's you just saying that, even giving voice to it, and...
It changes this equation by giving voice to it.
Yeah.
It really does, and I think everyone has to give voice to it. And I think everyone ultimately does have an opportunity to look into the face of this thing. And it sometimes helps to know that you're not alone.
Yeah. I guess I'm just saying thank you.
Thank you.
Because I'm going to stand up. So we had an interaction prior to being in here, and I went down to my tent, fucking freaked out, man. But my heart was really blown open at the same time, and it was. So that part of myself that I judged, you know, like, and I did for years, you know, tried to keep her down and out of that spot, and I was like freaking out because it was like I thought I was done with that, and I was so not done with that, and I had a really hard time while Deborah was talking to just hold myself in the room because I wanted to run away, which is that childhood pattern, you know. Too many people, too many things, like feeling like all the energies were coming in. But I realized that was part of that other pattern you were talking about, how I dissipated it was a childhood pattern to stop that feeling. So why am I standing on you? I just, you know, I'm like working with you at some place here.
Let me explain that we were having a conversation before, and at one point I said, stop talking. I said, shh. You're blowing all of your energy, you're talking way too much, nothing important is being said here other than just reaffirming a kind of noise. And I never do that with people usually. But now I've started. I just keep cutting to the quick because I think it's more important to talk to people about what they need to hear than to just say, of course, yes, 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 yes. And so I knew it was a bit brutal, but I knew it was important to happen. So I apologize if it was problematic, but it sounds like it worked.
No, it wasn't. I mean, I've had other teachers, and, you know.
Good.
Samurai.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, yeah, so.
So I think we're done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Can I just confirm, like, your first experience of feeling you were dying because you took some tablet or drank something.
You mean 40 years ago?
Yeah.
It was LSD. A big overdose of LSD.
Oh.
You know LSD?
I don't know.
Oh, it was a very popular drug in the 60s in America.
A drug. Oh.
A drug, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. It's a psychotropic drug that affects the, I don't know how to describe it. It takes you on a journey.
Crystal and I was at Paul Hedman together back when you were there. Right. And this is very interesting because Wednesday night I had a Reader's Digest condensed version of what you described. Like, it felt like I just got completely blown apart into the nothingness. And I had been experiencing this like really intense sort of contractedness. And I thought it was sort of, I went back to work recently, but I was off over the summer. I had my awakening and went back to my college teaching job. And I just felt like, oh, it's about maybe going to work or whatever. And I was like unwinding. And then I was reading Virginia Woolf's The Waves. And something I read in that just cast me into the abyss. And I just had this experience of like everything is nothing. I felt like myself got completely blown away. Everything was pointless. My teaching was pointless. So I was really touched by this. You're sharing this experience that we were in the same place. And I talked to Erica beforehand. Heard that she had this really intense experience. So it just really resonated with me. So.
I don't know that. All I can say is I believe it's process. And I think maybe tomorrow Bart will be able to put these in a clearer light. I don't mean to lay this on you, but I don't know it other than process. And I assume, Adi Ashanti called these unabiding awareness. And it doesn't mean he had one awakening, unabiding awakening. He had one awakening and then he lost it and it came back again. It may be that. I really don't know, and I don't claim to know.
Like, I wrote an email to my friend, and I just poured my heart in tears and cried. And then the next morning, I felt like it was like a thing had moved through, I felt like, phew, yeah.
Right, right.
But it's, I'm just really connected with that.
Thanks.
You're not alone.
Thanks.
Please. Yeah, are you afraid of dying?
Am I afraid of dying?
Yes.
I used to think no, but every time I put myself on that window ledge, there's...
Well, the awakening did not resolve that to you.
Interesting about Bruce, here's what happened. As Bruce disappeared, past experience started to fade. My memory started to fade. I thought I had Alzheimer's. I just couldn't remember things or people. In fact, everyone here whose name I don't remember from last year, forgive me. But it all went out the window. Future became totally unimportant and uninteresting to me. Not only that, but it became problematic because I don't like making plans for anything. Something for a week away could be 10 million years from now. It doesn't feel real. It constricts me in some way. So I tried not to. Because I was so in the present, death didn't rear its head. It just didn't. I felt relieved. I actually told people I'm not afraid of death because it just doesn't come into the picture. And then this thing happened and I realized there was something, I call it elemental or biological, that's afraid of death. Let me put this another way. Jesus Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane was scared to death of dying. Jesus went to the cross and was betrayed, he felt, by presence. It evaporated. He had no help. Why have you forsaken me? If Jesus can feel that, why not this person? I don't know that one escapes it. I don't know. Nisargadatta, at the end of his life, smoked his whole life, had throat cancer. He was not a happy camper. You can read his last books. He's miserable. Why did I ever get born? Is what he says. Death is biologically frightening, I think. There may be those great souls for whom it is not. But I was told, I don't know if this is a fact, that Ramana Maharshi was crying for his mother on his deathbed. So all I can tell you is We are biological entities. We can live without fear of death until the moment that death comes. And then maybe, maybe we'll be lucky. I just read an account in New York Magazine, a 9/11 thing, about a guy calling his wife on the 91st floor, knowing he'd never see her again. And he was completely, absolutely calm. So I think it may focus some of us in a really remarkable way. I have a friend whose father was 96 years old, who said, "Why me, God?" I mean, you're supposed to figure that out by the time you're 96. And my grandfather was 103. My grandfather had heart failure. They took him into the hospital. They said, "We can do something, if we do it right now, to save you." He said, "No, it's okay, I'm fine." And then they didn't do anything, and he went, "Oh my God, I'm going to die." He hadn't thought about it. And he said, "Can you save me?" They said, "No, there's nothing we can do." He died. So you think you're there, and maybe you are, some people are. I have no idea. I can only be honest that I stare at it, and stuff comes up. And right now what comes up is, "But my granddaughter, you know? I don't have much left beyond that I care about. But my granddaughter," I said. And, you know, it doesn't matter. One thing that will hold you back. I do believe that the goal of spiritual practice, I think it's all about one thing. I talk about this a lot. It's about the last moment and whether you say yes or no. You may have to fight to get there, but you say yes or no. And I used this image in my talks in my class recently. My two boys were in France and they were doing a bungee jump off a bridge in southern France. My younger son, Ari, walks to the edge of this platform and dives off. Like that, 2,000 feet or whatever. And I'm going like that. My older son, Josh, who's very much like me, has a guy, an instructor behind him, pushing him one step at a time to the edge like that. And every time Josh would take a little step, the guy would push him further, so he had no return whatsoever. He finally was at the very end, and I'm just dying inside. My kid jumping off something he doesn't want to jump off. And he just stood there, and then I watched this transformation, which I like to think we can all do, which he went, and he dove off. My mother-in-law, in her last hours on the planet, Alzheimer ridden, hooked up to machines, you name it. I arrive at the hospital to see her. I walk in the room and she looks at me and she goes, I'm praying that I arrive at that exact same place. Yes.
Sounds like you're getting repeated opportunities to say yes, but you've said no up to this point.
Yep. Call me human. What can I say? I don't know. I mean, I wish it wasn't that way. I mean, I actually had an opportunity last night. I didn't talk to you about that, but I had an opportunity to say yes, and I didn't do it. So, total failure on that account. Sorry. Yes.
It just came into my mind that, I remember Buddhism, you know, called the initial enlightenment as the start of self-cultivation, of the real start. And then, after the initial enlightenment, then when you're supposed to deal with the unfinished businesses.
Well, that may well be what's happening. I mean, I feel, like I said, process happening here, and I'm not freaked out about it at this time, and the fact that I'm able to share it with you is very therapeutic. That's all I can say.
And then reach the final, maybe perfect enlightenment.
Well, if that happens, I'll be happy to share that with you. But I don't want to frustrate people. What I really want people to know is there are different ways of getting enlightened. And there are different ways of being awakened. This is one. It's not as pretty as what some people have, but it's really, assuming that's what this is, I don't know. And truly, the not knowing has become the centerpiece of how I experience my day. I don't know. Have we done it? Okay, you don't have to applaud again. Thank you very much.